Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for June's Emergency Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, European and RCVS recognised specialist in veterinary soft tissue surgery, Catherine Sturgeon. Thank you, Catherine. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you, Emma. Well, welcome everybody to this lunchtime webinar. As you can see from the title, caesarean section, it is a very surgical title in many ways. However, certainly I've learned over the years to jump in feet first into the surgery is not necessarily the best thing for the patient and for outcomes of success of that procedure. So although very much we will be talking about the surgery, we will just spend the first section really just reminding ourselves of why we might need to do a caesarean section. Is it necessary even? And that looking at the physiology regarding the very complex process really of what's going on inside that dog or cat as they're on that verge of parturition about to give birth. And I think if we can understand those processes, then we're in a far better position to assess those patients, make the right decisions and have plans in place both preoperatively and postoperatively to get success. So first of all, if we think about dystochia, what actually is dystochia? And it really, on a very simple level, is the inability to expel that fetus through the uterus, through the birth canal. So why, for some animals, is that difficult? And I think if we remember back to when we were at university, this is really sort of split into two categories, and it does help to think about and rationalise things, to think about these categories. Primary inertia is probably the most common reason for dystochia, and this can be either complete, so this is where the dam or the queen is not passing any puppies or kittens, or it can be partial. So we might have passed one pup or one kitten, and then we seem to grind to a complete halt. I'll come back to primary inertia in a moment. Secondary inertia are where we have either maternal or fetal reasons for that inability to pass the actual fetus. So we may have got an obstruction of the fetus in the uterus. We may have got an abnormally large fetus. The fetus may be not a normal position. The bitch itself or the queen may have actually a congenital or a pelvic abnormality due to trauma. There may be strictures present within the uterus, within the vagina. So a whole multitude of problems could be present. Certainly with many causes, going back again to the primary inertia here, oftentimes it's difficult to know why exactly it may be. And in certain breeds, very large breed dogs, for instance, and wolfhounds, etc., if we have a very large litter present, then that can give rise to the overstretching of the myometrium and exhaustion of that muscle. Equally, if we have a very small litter and we just have a very big solitary puppy, then there may be inadequate uterine stimulation actually present. It's unusual, certainly, for a low calcium or a low glucose to be the cause of secondary inertia, and likewise malnutrition. And certainly for those of you that have travelled to different countries, I'm sure you will have all seen very, very ribby dogs walking around the streets with hordes of puppies chasing behind them. So malnutrition doesn't seem to certainly cause a problem in actually giving birth in that way. Certainly lots of studies have looked at, could it be that there's a low oxytocin level? Could it be that the serum prostaglandin levels are too low, etc.? But there's nothing been reproducibly proven that this is the case. So quite often it's quite hard to put your finger on exactly why this could be happening. So Is there actually a problem? So when we're presented with a pregnant dog or queen in the hospital, in the surgery, is there a problem? And often the owner rushes in, they're very worried because they know they've had their dog mated and they think they're sort of the due date's arriving, but is there a problem? So with complete primary inertia, I guess what we'd expect to see really are very vague signs, or maybe no signs of parturition whatsoever. Equally, we may have got a sort of a lack of progression. So we may have started with the first stage of labour, but we're not really transitioning onto that second stage within a time frame of 12 to 24 hours. Also, if we're monitoring temperatures, which owners, breeders should be doing, we will often see as we start to get near to parturition, as you can remember, that the temperature drops. And again, if we've got this drop in temperature, but yet the hours are ticking by and nothing more is happening, then again, this could start to raise question marks of actually. I think there could be a problem with this dam or queen giving birth. With partial uterine inertia, though, there can be very prolonged intervals, and even in a normal sequence of events, particularly with dogs, you know, there can be a 2 hour, a 3 hour break between puppies sometimes where there's no contractions. The bitch seems very settled. The pup that's already been born is moving around and starting to nuzzle and starting to want to suckle, but nothing's happening. So I would say that certainly if we're getting towards the 4 hour mark and nothing more is happening, then again, we need to start thinking, oh, hang on a moment, is there really a problem present? You know, the dog. When scanned a week ago, you know, potentially had three puppies there, yet we've only got one. So 4 hours is probably your upper limit of normal. Looking at a bitch, obviously full physical examination is key. And if we have got vaginal discharge, so this thing called lochia, which is really the discharge you get after parturition has taken place, so this is mucus, blood, maybe some uterine tissue. If you're getting that type of discharge, but actually no fetus has actually been delivered yet or passed, then absolutely that's a warning sign that, you know, things are really not right at all. If we do a vaginal examination, we certainly. It depends really on the, I guess, the breed of the dog as well. You may be able to palpate that there's actually, you know, an obstruction in the birth canal. Is there a stricture? Is the puppy actually stuck? So that's always worth gently doing. Obviously, gloved finger, plenty of lubrication, and nothing is ever done forcefully. And it does depend, say, on the breed of the dog. Certainly, a lot of Chihuahuas we see nowadays, this would be not possible. And if, when we're doing that examination, there's no real response of abdominal contractions in response to that vaginal gentle exam. Again, that's a little bit unusual, and alarm bells may again ring that something's just not quite right. One thing that is important to remember is with a digital examination in a bitch, and even in a large breed, we cannot feel the cervix. So I personally thought for a very long time that during that examination, I would be able to tell if the cervix was open or not. Well, the truth is, to be honest, in a pregnant female where everything has the genital tract has flopped more forwards into the abdomen over the pelvic brim, the cervix, as you can imagine, also just displaces and stretches and is more cranial in position. So really and truly, the only way you're actually going to tell anything about the cervix is with endoscopy. So do not rely on digital palpation to know actually about whether the cervix is opening or opened sufficiently or not, because you will not be able to tell. So what can we do to try to diagnose? Is there something amiss, and do we need to take action, whether that be medical or surgical? So radiography is a very good way at this stage of defining, have we still got a bitch with puppies? That you know, is the dog actually definitely pregnant? Radiographic signs with regards to the skeleton mineralization of puppies, it's normally evident from about day 57. So that's just something worth bearing in mind. And radiography is, it's a very accurate way of looking for these fetal and determining fetal numbers, and we are looking at sort of 90, 93%, you know, accuracy there with being able to determine presence and numbers at that stage. Ultrasound is not quite as well. Ultrasound is not as accurate to determine fetal numbers, etc. But what it is very useful for is looking for fetal distress. So colleagues in the practice that are very good with the ultrasound will be able to see the heartbeat of these puppies. And certainly in a conscious dam, so this is a dam before obviously going under anesthesia, any sedatory effects at all, with a puppy, healthy fetus's heart rate should be over 200 beats per minute, so very, very fast. So if we've got a heart rate that's less than 150 beats per minute in a conscious pregnant female, then that's a sign that the fetus is stressed, it's hypoxic, etc. It's really not coping very well. Just to go back to the X-ray, again, always take the opportunity to look around the X-ray as always. So, although we're focusing very much in on the uterine area, the fetuses, are the fetuses there? Just always take a glance over, you know, cardiac area, lung fields, check, you know, that there's nothing else unusual or obvious going on with the bitch. And probably a very, well, it is a very accurate way of knowing, have we got impending parturition in these females, is if we have a measure of serum progesterone. And serum progesterone will take a real dip down as a dam or a queen is nearing term. So quite often, unless we've got a dog owner, a breeder that is really planning to the nth degree, and they have pre-ovulation serum progesterone levels available, they are planning an elective C-section, this gives them a very accurate indication of due date. Quite often, as I think you'll agree, that's often really not the case when we're in practice. And the accurate dates are more difficult to determine, because we've often not got those pre-ovulation serum progesterones at hand for that particular individual. So sometimes we are then left with looking at the progesterone at that point in time, where they've been brought into the clinic. So taking a serum sample, and utilizing perhaps one of the SNAP test kits, if we've got a level that's less than 2 nanograms per mil, then again, this is a good indication that actually, you know, this bitch is on the verge of parturition, and things should be moving along, should have moved along, if she's now, if there are other signs of distress to either the dam or the fetus. The progesterone test kits, just to say, they are often ELISA based. They're not ultra accurate when we're looking at these lower ranges of progesterone, but obviously they are often the thing that we have on hand in a practice at night, at the weekend, etc. So still absolutely worth testing. And as always, it's part of a bigger picture. It's piecing together all this information to best then know in which direction we're going to move forward. So once we have established that we have a patient with dystochia, how then are we going to treat? Is this medical, or do we need to really move quite quickly to considering a C-section? So certainly with primary uterine inertia, so this is where we've got a female, the owners are fairly certain of a mating date. We've got our X-ray. We know there are fetuses there, but we've really got no signs of anything. We've checked. There's no obvious obstruction, etc. We start with oxytocin, and we would definitely want to give that a try with that injection in that situation, first of all. If a bitch has been certainly having intermittent contractions for a while, and certainly, as we've said, if we've got, and we'll come on to a moment, very prolonged and strong contractions and nothing's happening, then clearly cesarean, really, we should move to quite quickly. But where a bitch, is not, is contracting a little bit and then stopping again and so on, but nothing is happening over a period of hours, then these bitches can get exhausted. They can get, they're not likely to run low in glucose and calcium, perhaps, but they're probably going to get very dehydrated. So whilst we don't want to stress these patients, and it has to be done on a very much case-to-case basis as well, it is worth considering in some cases taking that blood sample, looking at electrolytes, maybe fitting a cannula at that stage if it's not going to be too stressful for that bitch, so that you can provide fluid therapy. That's not necessarily in every case, but could be considered in some cases. If a puppy is produced, then we can repeat the oxytocin, as you know, and that can be repeated every 30 minutes. And again, just sometimes the gentle manipulation, feeling, examining the vaginal area can just sort of stimulate a little bit the parturition process. Occasionally, fetuses can be encouraged, shall we say, from the vagina with digital examinations, but traction, these puppies, kittens are tiny, and it has to be done very slowly, very carefully. And again, in many ways, it's breed dependent. A lot of the, I think you'd agree that the dogs, the dogs we see most commonly that come in for potential cesarean sections are small breed dogs in a lot of cases, so digital examination, let alone attraction of a fetus, may not be possible. So the indications of for actually moving forward to a cesarean section, that's probably again easier to remember these points in many ways. So clearly, if we've had a couple of doses of oxytocin in a bitch where there's no other obvious reason why she's not passing these puppies or kittens or in a queen, then that would be indication to move to C-section. If a queen or a dam is really pushing hard and they've been pushing hard for 30 minutes and still no pup or kitten is produced, we should move forward to a C-section. Clearly, if there is obstruction in the canal, a stricture, obvious fetal malpositioning, C-section. And as we said before, if that heart rate of the fetus on ultrasound is less than 150, then no question, we should start to think of surgery. Now, before we move on to the surgery itself, I want just to take a step back and think about what is happening physiology-wise, really, pathophysiology-wise, with this pregnant queen or dam. We know that the pregnant animals, and particularly towards the end of term, there's a real increase in circulating plasma volume, slight increase in red blood cells. So there's a relative anemia process going on, really, so that we can maintain good blood flow to the placenta. So these patients have, obviously a uterus full of puppies or a big puppy or lots of kittens, and there may be pressure to the venous return on the vena cava. The diaphragm is being put through its paces with increased pressure, so the residual volume within the lungs is going to be less. The patients are going to have to take shorter breaths in order to oxygenate well, and this is obviously when they are conscious. So when we potentially start, and maybe quite suddenly, tipping the balance into anesthesia, these patients initially may cope well with hypovolemia, some blood loss during the surgery, but then incredibly quickly they will decompensate, incredibly quickly, and they will have low blood pressure, they will suddenly develop tachycardia, and because of that, we need to be very prepared as veterinarians and veterinary nurses to have thought about this before we start, and therefore we can deal and address with these situations as they arise, or hopefully maybe have done certain things beforehand to prevent them happening, or certainly minimize, for instance, a low blood pressure situation, minimize the pressure to the vena cava, etc. So, on a practical level, what can we do when we're thinking about we're going to do a C-section? Clearly, we need to put this patient under anesthesia. What do we need to make sure we've got in mind? So, pregnant bitches have at least 20% increase in their oxygen requirement. So they're stressed, they've been potentially straining to pass this fetus. They're maybe quite tired, they're tachypneic. So pre-oxygenation is a simple thing to do, and again, being part of the Emergency Club webinar here, this I know will be a very familiar technique to you all. Quite a lot of bitches don't necessarily tolerate being masked, but they will tolerate a bit of flow by. And do bear in mind that potentially quite a lot of bitches presenting for potential C-section are brachycephalics. So again, this should be commonplace anyway when putting a brachycephalic under GA. So pre-oxygenation absolutely is key, but for any breed. Pregnant bitches also have quite a vast increase in their cardiac output, right up to 40%. So again, we need to be capable of maintaining blood pressure, and the best way really of being able to maintain our blood pressure is to have or to be able to use intravenous fluid therapy. So in order to do that, we need an IV catheter in place. Now, we need to be efficient and swift when we are undergoing anesthesia and we're doing a C-section, and we don't want to stress the patient necessarily when they're conscious. Now, some bitches you will be able to place an IV catheter prior to that induction without any stress, and that would be optimal to have the catheter in place before we start, because again, it's a time factor as well. And if we're for any reason struggling to place a catheter under GA, we don't want the bitch under anesthesia for ages and ages while everybody's fiddling and faffing around trying to get an IV catheter in. But for those bitches that are quite stressed and agitated, because for reasons we're going to come on to shortly about the pros and cons of pre-meds, it may be that we are induced into anesthesia and then the catheter is placed immediately, the IV catheter is placed immediately afterwards. So, but there we have access, and access to intravenous access is vital really, if it can be something easily put into that particular breed of dog, which for most breeds, let's face it, we can usually get catheters into most breeds nowadays. And again, harking back to a lot of these patients might be brachycephalic, almost to me, as a surgeon who does lots of airway surgery and brachycephalics, I would feel it suicidal not to have intravenous access in those patients. As we've already mentioned briefly, we've got a large uterus. We're going to have a reduction in venous return, and this is completely exacerbated when these patients are put into dorsal recumbency. And on top of that, we have then got more pressure exerted towards the diaphragm. And in some bitches, this can be really quite catastrophic. They're really not going to be ventilating well. Their venous return is affected. So how can we, minimize these effects? Well, as we've already said, pre-oxygenation, again, absolutely key in all patients. It also gives us a longer interval to actually place our ET tube. So there's never any panic or rush. We're going to keep these patients in sternal. I must admit, I tend to do a sternal position intubation for all my patients anyway, no matter what I'm doing. But it does give you time to then place a tube of the correct size. You're not jabbing and poking in and around the glottic area. You can do it nice and safely, but at the same time, it means the patient is not laid in lateral and sort of head crooked round and so on, whilst that's trying to be while the ETB is being placed. Having a slight elevation once they're in dorsal recumbency, so i.e. having a slight tilt on the table so that the thorax, just like you would in a diaphragmatic rupture repair, is an excellent thing to do. Now, not everyone's got a tilting table, and certainly in all the practices where I operate, that's not always the case. But I think as vets, we're very good at improvising, and certainly you could use a board raised by some towels underneath, just to give that slight elevation of the thorax to try and improve the ventilation for that patient. And during, particularly induction, but even to some degree during the surgery where needed, if you are able to do some gentle manual ventilation until the patient's really settling, then a sigh breath. So this is not constant ventilation, but just intermittent manual ventilation, just to improve that ability to respire, particularly during that first induction phase, is again a really important thing to do. For those of you in the audience today, perhaps that have had children, again, I'm sure you have probably all experienced the unpleasant fact that we reflux more. So if we are pregnant, the lower esophageal sphincter is perhaps a little bit slacker. And just the fact that we've got elevated progesterone in our systems will decrease gastric emptying. So all those things together, and then we've got a stomach that's being perhaps pressed by a really gravid uterus at the time of parturition, we're more likely to have gastroesophageal reflux. And as some of you may have experienced, this can be a real issue. And from time to time, there will be, bitches that have had a spave and not even necessarily a cesarean where they've had reflux, and then so many weeks later they're regurgitating and they've got severe esophageal stricture. So it can be catastrophic, the effects of refluxing gastric acid. So again, as an aid, where we've got a pregnant bitch who is far more likely to reflux, have suction available. So suction does not need to be expensive. This is my little machine that I have. It's under £100, and I purchase disposable suction tubing. I have some disposable suction heads here, and this is often worth its weight in gold, because it means if reflux does happen at the stage of induction, you've got the machine there, you can do something about it. So suction equipment, vital, not only potentially intraoperatively, but actually in the prep area, actually as you're inducing. Have a good depth of anaesthesia as well. Dogs that are very light under GA are more likely to reflux. As we've said, consider the tilted table. And some patients, again, may well benefit from GIT protectants post-operatively. This certainly would be something I would instigate if a patient has obviously refluxed. And to be honest, it would be something that I would always do if my patient was brachycephalic. And this is because brachycephalic breeds, with their airway obstructions that they have, are often subclinical refluxes, regardless of whether they're pregnant, about to go through parturition or not. So even if it's just a 5-day, 7-day course, then that could be something to consider, and not necessarily having deleterious effects to the neonates. Now, one of the key things, again, we should really take note of before we start rushing into theatre is not only the consent for the surgery that we might need to perform, but also the consent for unlicensed drugs. And the reason I emphasise this is really no drugs, no anaesthesia agents, no analgesia agents, no antibiotics, nothing is going to be really licensed for that pregnant female and her neonates. So it's incredibly important to have that discussion with the owner, no matter how quick that discussion is. They need to be very aware that for you to do your job properly and to do what is best for the dam and her neonates, you may need to use, well, you need to use drugs, you need to use analgesia. It would be unethical not to do so. But not only do you need to have had that verbal discussion, but the owners need to sign that they understand that conversation and that they have consented to the use of those medications for the essential welfare of their dog and the puppies that hopefully you are going to deliver if you're moving to a C-section. So a little pointer there, but incredibly important and good practice. So which induction agents should we consider? I think certainly, I've jumped ahead of myself there, the pre-med. Generally, a pre-med is not given. I don't give a pre-med, and it always seems very alien, but a pre-med is not given. The only time I might give a pre-med, maybe if I have got a very fractious temperamental patient that I am struggling to get anywhere near to do anything with, then I think if that were the case, then I would perhaps use a low dose of an opiate medication. So, and methadone probably would be my one of choice because it's very potent, but it's very short acting. But as a general rule, and thankfully, I think most bitches we see that are coming in because they have dystochia, etc., they're usually very nice breeds we're seeing. They're usually very nice-natured, and often they're exhausted, tired, and the last thing on their mind is biting somebody and being obstructive in that way. So no pre-medication. And the reason for that clearly is that it limits then transfer of yet more drugs via the placenta that could then affect the neonates with then sort of respiratory depression, etc. thereafter. The drugs certainly, so we're going to have no pre-med as our ideal. Induction agents, it's certainly not the time to experiment. You stick to what you know and what you're confident with, and don't start experimenting with other drugs. You're really looking for short acting medications, and I would, on the whole, the ones in red on your screen here today are things that I would avoid, as certainly any pre-sedation or anaesthesia agents, for various reasons. Some of these agents are very vasodilatory. Some, particularly if we look at ketamine is fairly nice with regards to its cardiovascular effects, etc. But it does really need medetomidine or benzodiazepines to work with it. But the medetomidine would not be advised, and the benzodiazepines certainly, they have a very good uptake in neonates and can depress neurological reflexes and gives you this sort of floppy, sloppy, fetal syndrome. So everything in red you really should not need to contemplate using. Inhalational agents, again, so if we were going to just do a gaseous induction, Again, that can be really quite distressing. I think you'll agree, isoflurane can be really quite irritant on those mucous membranes. The bitch is more likely to reflux, I think, as well, have gastroesophageal reflux if you're starting to use inhalational agents. So that again is really not an ideal situation. We can't, any drug that we use, we cannot stop it. That there will be some crossover, to the placenta to some degree. So the key here is, as we've said, use short-acting agents, have good oxygenation for the dam and the queen throughout, and this will limit very much acid-base changes then in that fetus. So the two agents of choice have to be really propofol and alfaxolone. I'm happy to use both. You will certainly find that because progesterone is in the system of the dam and the queen, that that alone has sedatory effects. So you'll find that perhaps you do need to use less induction agent and you do need to use less gaseous anesthesia when we come to maintenance. So just bear that in mind. But as always, be aware, propofol, it will cause that bit of apnea. It will cause that little bit of hypertension. But usually, there is certainly no obvious residual effect in the neonates. Once there's been a lag phase from induction, realistically, by the time we've then clipped and prepped and got into theatre, we've probably got 15, 20 minutes before then that first puppy is being removed as from cesarean section. So, and that's long enough then, for that drug to be really starting to metabolize through. And so there should be minimal residual effects to puppies and kittens. So we still should get good spontaneous ventilation with those products. Gaseous anesthesia obviously will be the way to maintain as always, and again we find in the in any of our patients nice rapid uptake and nice rapid elimination taking place there. I put this image on the screen of all the ET tubes. I think again this is always essential, and hopefully most practices now have got a real array of sizes. So always have exactly that, lots of different sizes available. And do remember, your brachycephalic dogs. I know I keep talking about them a lot today, but they really and truly are often requiring a lot smaller tube, particularly the pugs, French bulldogs. You might be looking at a size 5 to a 5.5 as your absolute maximum ET size. They're certainly not an 8 or anything that large. With regards to analgesia, this to me is, it's a welfare issue. It's absolutely vital. We're doing a cesarean section. We're doing a midline ciliotomy. If we want that dam or queen to wake up and be friendly and wanting to see the kittens and puppies and letting them suckle around a midline incision, then they're going to need pain control. So remember again, though, none of these drugs are licensed in the use of a bitch undergoing parturition and the neonates. So that's again where your consent form is very important, that that is documented, that the owner understands. And analgesia, unlike other surgeries that we do, again, we're going to give this once the last puppy or kitten has been removed intraoperatively. So by that I mean once the uterus has been incised, pups and kittens have been removed, then you can give your analgesia. So you can get your methadone on board, you can get your non-steroidal on board if that's what you're choosing to do. Again, just always be watchful with blood pressures when using non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs intraoperatively. Perhaps, I'm not going to say less of a worry if the animal's on fluids, but again, just cautious. You might still want to give that just before the bitch is waking up. Paracetamol intravenous use is very, very handy, and it's something that I use more and more of nowadays for lots of my surgeries, but never in cats. Remember, you can't use intravenous paracetamol in cats. But this gives a very nice level of pain control for 6 to 8 hours. So, yeah, very, very useful in dogs. And you can also consider using a splash block local anaesthesia splashed along the linear alba or slightly injected along the linear alba. So there's lots of options there. And there's no doubt that hopefully then will give, you know, that queen or that dam that's undergone the surgery, they'll be far more likely to be, I think, accepting of then the pups and kittens that have been delivered. People worry a little bit about methadone. I wouldn't have any worries in using it. I use a very, I use a low dose, and it's really has metabolized, gone 3 to 4 hours. There's no hangover effect. So at the end of the day, you've got a hopefully then a bright dam or queen that is wanting to nurture those puppies and kittens. Antibiotics, a quick slide on the use of, this is a really a clean contaminated surgery, isn't it? And as we all know, really, for antibiotics to be effective, they do need to be in the patient's bloodstream at the time of surgery. So this is a difficult one because we're not going to necessarily do that because we've got puppies and kittens. We wouldn't, again, none of these drugs are licensed. It would be very common in other surgeries to use potentiated amoxicillin and cephalosporin at the time of induction, but it's not routine and certainly not, perhaps ill-advised really where we're doing cesarean sections. So it's my advice here would be we'll come to the surgery section now and we're going to try and limit contamination to the abdomen, keep everything exteriorized and therefore limit then the chance of infections taking hold. A lot of people will use subcutaneous antibiotics post-op. It won't prevent infection because obviously I think by then the body will have decided whether the bacteria have taken hold because we haven't got any prophylactic antibiotics within the blood system. But so that could be used. Equally, if you're happy with the surgery and you feel contamination is absolutely minimal, then there's also argument to say, you know, no use of antibiotics at all. So there's some food for thought there. No necessary sort of wrong or right answers. So with regards to our C-section, as always with any surgical procedure, it pays to be prepared. And these are often urgent, they're emergency situations, but there's no reason still why everything cannot be prepared in advance for these situations. And this is where checklists are handy. Not just having the checklist in your head, but having it, you know, written down so that we can tick off and make sure that everything is in that theatre ready to go is absolutely ideal. So big laparotomy swabs are incredibly useful. And also, again, we've got our suction. Bipolar diathermy, I use it for everything. So it's something I always have in case I need to use for extra reasons of hemostasis, not necessarily to a uterus, but even on the approach into an abdomen, I will always have it there. And retractors, again, you know, are useful, having a pair of gusset retractors available. Equally, thinking about the after event as well, we need to have our towels at the ready, warm kennel, hopefully lots of eager people to help out. And this is great if it happens during the day because the reception staff are there, the nurses, or the vets, everyone likes to get involved in cesareans. It's usually a really exciting and happy event. Not so easy if it's overnight, but have all of this ready before you start. Less haste, more speed is definitely the way to go before that bitch is induced. Think about the fact that afterwards we may need to suction away fluid gunge from the puppies or kittens' airways. So having 1 mL syringes available, or even just some small IV catheters, or even lacrimal cannulas for flushing tear ducts, they can be really quite handy. Have those available. So with regards to the surgery, we'll look at some tips here. So again, I mention again about hydration, patient hydrated. Ideally, yes, absolutely. Why not? So, you know, if a patient can be on fluids, that has to be the ideal optimal way to go. The patient needs to be kept warm as well. Just slapping them onto a cold operating surface is not going to be helpful. But also, again, be careful with certain warming devices. I've certainly see a lot of there's a lot of keenness out there for keeping patients warm, but I think there can be other extremes, and sometimes some of the warming devices can be actually incredibly dangerous. So do have them underneath towels and bedding rather than directly on the in contact with the skin. Clearly, we're hoping the cesarean patients are not going to be under anaesthesia for long, because we want them awake and we want them recovering. We want them then nurturing the pups and the kittens. But with surgery, you never quite know what's going to happen. So just be well prepared and think about where those warming devices actually are positioned. Do a big enough clip as well. So right from the xiphoid, I go right down to the pubic area. So a nice big area, clipped and prepped. Tilt the table again, and you're not going to skimp on how this is approached in the way that we are going to prepare ourselves and dress. So, you know, you are going to have a gown on, you are going to have gloves on, you're going to drape, you're going to count your swabs. It's automatic. You do the things that you do to the high standard you would for any other patient. Less haste, more speed. When we're doing our celiotomy, just remember that the abdominal wall has been pushed out with this huge great uterus, and so the linear alba can be really thin, particularly in cats. So be very careful, use your forceps to hold up the linear alba to make that incision through, otherwise you might find you're into the bladder or you're into the uterus far quicker than you actually had planned, and potentially that could be dangerous. So we are then going to carefully exteriorize the uterus, and do this carefully, taking the weight of the uterus up and out. Don't be tempted to grab a small section through a far too smaller approach, because uterus can rupture, and then that's a real messy problem to have to sort out. So big enough incision and gently lift that uterus up and away. As you can see in the picture here, we're really getting those abdominal swabs packed in and around. And again, this is great, because if we can eliminate contamination to the abdomen, then perhaps again we don't need to use those antibiotics thereafter. Ideally, we're going to incise into the uterine body in order to find and locate our first puppy. So we'd always want to try to remove the most caudal puppy first of all. We are then going to, once that puppy's been located, we're going to open the amniotic sac, and then with hemostats clamp the umbilical cord. Now, I do it in this way. You may read some texts that will talk about teasing the entire fetus and its placenta first, then opening the amniotic sac and then clamping. In my experience, I think particularly with C-sections, you may find that the placenta is not that keen to come away from the wall straight away, and trying to tease it for too long could lead to quite excessive hemorrhage. So I probably would not do that. I tend to open the amniotic sac, fetus, clamp the umbilical cord. Don't be tempted to clamp the umbilical cord too short is another tip. Leave it quite long, between 2 to 3 centimeters in length. And it also means then that if you want to use that cord and vein for any, if you do have to give any medications, intravenously, you've actually, you've got a length to work with rather than a tiny little stub at the umbilicus there. Immediately, once the puppy's been removed, clearly we're then going to pass to an assistant, and the key two things are going to be airway and breathing. So we want to clear the airway, we want to stimulate the breathing, and we tend to do that by just gentle rubbing. Again, nowadays it would be ill-advised to start swinging any neonate puppies or kittens, because this could cause cerebral edema and hemorrhage. They people do it because it maybe gets fluid from the lungs, and you'll have seen sort of sheep being swung in a similar fashion. But really, it's not appropriate for any species to go through that. It's really quite dangerous, so that's not necessary. Going back to the placenta, so if we have if the fetus has come away, and the placenta has we've then handed the fetus to our assistants. Sometimes you can just then tease the placenta away and out it comes, which is fine. But if it doesn't, just leave it where it is. Eventually it will just come out naturally. As we said earlier, if you forcibly remove a placenta, it will hemorrhage quite catastrophically. So definitely there's no need to be tempted to do that. So back to the dam. We check the pelvic canal for any more puppies before closure. So, one of the main problems in cesareans or mistakes is leaving a puppy in. So, do thoroughly check down towards the pelvic canal that there are no puppies located deep down in this direction here. If we've removed our fetus that was in the uterine body, but we've still got fetuses in really in the horns, and we're having difficulty milking them down towards the surgical site, you can certainly make an incision in the horn. That's perfectly fine to remove the puppy or the kitten in those locations on either side. That's perfectly acceptable. How do we close a uterus? Well, it's either in one or two layers. And I tend to use appositional sutures, so a simple interrupted or a simple continuous pattern. Again, it is acceptable. You can use, if you were doing a two layer, you could use an appositional layer, and then you could use an inverting layer. But personally, I tend to use appositional, and I use monofilament suture material. And overall, I tend to use 4-0, 1.5 metric. Suture material for pretty much most of my uterine closures. I will rinse off the uterus after that has been performed, and again, hopefully with the abdominal swabs that have been in place, all any debris hopefully is collected on those and not actually gone into the abdomen. And really, by the start, the end of your closure, even perhaps even before the start of the closure, you'll see that uterus start to involute and start to get smaller and contract. If it hasn't done by the time you're just about to start your closure, then you can start some oxytocin perhaps. So the linea alba, simple continuous suture, again is what I would use. So if I've got a 10 kilo dog, I would use a 2-0 monofilament material, and then I do tend to do subcutaneous and intradermal sutures. It just means skin sutures are acceptable, but it just means that they could be a nuisance if the puppies kittens are trying to suckle, or the puppies and kittens could see them as a sort of a plaything, and then it could interrupt the way the bitch actually heals to a degree, or equally, puppy kitten could end up with a bit of a foreign body situation, or an obstruction potentially to an airway in the back of the throat there. So the downside of intradermal, perhaps it takes a little bit longer on average. So horses for courses there, both acceptable, but I do tend to do intradermal where I can for those patients. You might say, what about owners that request neutering at the same time as cesarean? Or equally, it may be that there is a situation you're coming across during the surgery whereby, for instance, the uterus has ruptured, etc. You deem it needs to be removed at the same time as cesarean. Yes, this is totally possible, but again, please remember you must have consent of the owner to do that. So again, it's worth voicing before you start, is that something they want to be done if the dog's coming in because it's got dystochia and having problems? Are they likely to breed again? If the answer's no, do they want to consider neutering at the same time? Have that brief discussion so that you've got it in writing, you've got your signature, and then there's no argument thereafter. It's quite common in cats to do an ovohysterectomy at the same time as a cesarean, and it can work very, very well. So to go about this, we would tend to do an en bloc resection, so i.e. the celiotomy is performed, and then we're going to triple clamp pedicles, double clamp the uterine bodies near the cervix area, making sure obviously that all puppies, kittens are well away from the clamps, and then the whole structure here is handed to a separate team of people. They will then unclamp the uterus, carefully cut with scissors, and open out the uterus, retrieve the puppy's kittens, and start the resuscitation process. Meanwhile, you as the surgeon, you carry on then finishing the spay procedure with your ligations. Do bear in mind that you have 60 seconds from when the clamps are put on for the whole uterus containing pups and kittens to be removed, handed out, and puppies and kittens to be retrieved. Otherwise, they will get severe hypoxia. So it needs to be timed. There need to be enough people in order to do that resuscitation process of the fetuses and the kittens, of the puppies and kittens rather. Okay, so just to finish up on these last few slides, as I think probably everybody in the audience has already got the gist, we do need extra precaution with our brachycephalic patients. There are so many about nowadays. They're such popular breeds because they are lovely dogs, but their airways already are compromised, and now they've got a gravid uterus and they're going to have to potentially go through cesarean. So as I've already said, make sure you've got plenty of small size tubes available. You must recover these dogs in sternal. Don't just recover them like any other breed. I keep their endotracheal tube in place until they're literally looking at me. There is no need to panic and remove a tube very quickly. There really, really isn't. I think there is a lot of temptation as soon as a patient sort of starts to swallow, you remove the tube. And I think that's drilled and drummed into us certainly when I was at vet school many, many years ago. But I think we've learnt a lot over the years, and certainly with the brachycephalic dogs, they can swallow and then they can go back to sleep for literally half an hour. And if they go back to sleep for half an hour with their big fat tongue in their mouth and they're not panting, etc., then they're going to become hypoxic quite quickly. So let them really come round, then remove the ET tube. You won't have a problem. You will be able to remove it. They may need extra flow by oxygen, even when the tube has been removed. Hold up the sides of their lips to let the oxygen go in and around them. I would say to you, don't be tempted to shove their head in an oxygen mask, because again, if they can't pant and they can't get their tongue out, then sometimes having your face literally shoved into an oxygen mask, believe it or not, can cause cyanosis. So just, they need to be able to move their lips, move their tongue, and have the oxygen gently going around them in that sort of environment. And as we've said, they're all really, I think, subclinical. They have gastroesophageal reflux. So again, horses for courses, but again, it might be that you consider that you do want to do a short course post-operatively of gastroprotectants, but again, needing owner's consent. These drugs are not licensed where we've got a dog that's just gone through parturition with neonates. So very briefly, but onto our little puppy or kitten, there are many reasons why we might get a depression of puppies and kittens that aren't doing well. Lack of oxygen, blocked airways, we may be cold, poor circulation. There could be some residual effects of drugs going on. Probably, as we've said, the two main key things really are we must clear the airway. There's no doubt about that at all. We always do the sensible thing in that we need to listen for the heartbeat, check muscle tone, look for general vitality, but clearing the airway and general stimulation, gentle rubbing are the most important things to do to revive that little kitten, keep them warm. If we want to maybe try to stimulate respiration, I learnt something a little while ago now from a friend who said that if you have it needs to be a blunted needle, not a pointy needle. If you just gently poke around the nasal philtrum, there's almost like a little acupuncture point there, which can stimulate breathing. So that is worth considering. Be aware that certainly too much oxygen can be harmful. So if we just put a puppy into an oxygen kennel and pump it full of oxygen, that's actually not going to be very helpful at all for stimulating good and healthy respiration. Doxapram has really gone out of vogue these days, I would say, as a stimulant. It really does increase the myocardial oxygen consumption. So if we've got a pup that's already quite hypoxic, that really is going to make the situation worse. So if you are going to use doxapram under the tongue or a little bit IV in the umbilical vein, etc., you must support with oxygen. So generally, as a general rule, I don't use it. Again, just as a reminder, we've got our IV access in a young puppy, young kitten. The access points you're looking at, either umbilical, jugular, interosseous, should you need to give anything. It's not often we need to in order to resuscitate, but if I did, I'd probably use the umbilical vein because it's more accessible, and hopefully we've left a good length of it once in that process when we were doing our clamping. So how quickly should we return our little neonates back to the dam? The answer, as I'm sure you'll know, is as soon as possible, really. As soon as the bitch or the queen is recovered, anaesthesia, she's alert, and she's ready to actually engage, with those puppies and kittens. Common sense things, really. Make sure that the bottom area is clean. Sometimes if these bitches have been straining a while, they'll be covered in, green goo and blood and mucus, etc. So although in a natural way she would clean that, don't forget she's just had a cesarean section, she's recovering that, she's recovering her methadone, etc. So so the mothering instinct in us all should kick in, and we should just get them cleaned up so that the pups, as they're crawling around, aren't getting covered horrible fetid material. And equally as important, just make sure that any surgical scrub preparation is no longer on the ventrum or around the mammary glands, because again, that is not going to be conducive to pups suckling and the dam nurturing the puppies and kittens. Further checks. Again, just logical, common sense things, really. We're going to check for congenital abnormalities. Has the dam actually got any milk letdown yet? Do we need to supplement? We may do, but again, as always, be very careful with regards to aspiration. And again, always just reiterate to those owners, because we might think, oh, they're going back to the owners and they're going to be fine, but I don't know, sometimes people are breeding dogs for various reasons here, and they might not potentially have got the dog's interests best at heart. We do need a quiet environment, a warm environment at home, a secure environment. They don't necessarily need to be sat by the television in the crate. They need it warm, warm and quiet in order to be able to then to thrive. So thank you very much for listening today. As always, I've run over, and so I deeply apologise to those of you listening in today. I have got time for a couple of questions, so I will run through those quickly for you all. And thank you for posting quite a few here. So I'm just going to select a few. So question number one, do I exteriorize the entire uterus prior to the incision, or just a singular section? In answer to that question, I Personally, I do exteriorize most of the uterus on my abdominal swabs, and then I make my desired incision into the uterus. And the second question was, what is your reasoning for a singular uterine incision rather than a long horn? That I think that question might have been asked before I went on to talking about the horn. So, but just to reiterate, I would tend to make an incision in the uterine body as my first incision, but there, if the puppy's kittens are very much still located in the horns and they're not easily milked to the uterine body incision, it's perfectly acceptable to make an incision in a uterine horn. One other question, maybe. Let me have a look. Use of epidurals, do we use them? Flatly, no, we don't. I think they're unnecessary in this situation. Our patients are going to undergo general anaesthesia anyway, and then potentially the patient's got to recover the epidural, etc. So the answer is no, I don't think they are indicated, and it's not something I would advocate. One last very, very quick question, which is a very good question, so I just want to does if we did an overhysterectomy at the same time as the cesarean, does this affect milk letdown? Good question. The answer is no. Milk letdown, i.e., prolactin release, is central and it is independent of ovarian hormones. So, although when a dog's had cesarean section, it may be a little bit prolonged in milk letdown purely because the body wasn't necessarily quite ready to give birth, i.e., we've intervened, so the body's just got to catch up slightly in that way. The actual event of prolactin release, if you've done an overhysterectomy at the same time, is not affected at all. So I hope that answers your question. Thank you again, everybody, for listening in today, and I hope you've picked up some tips and refreshed your knowledge with regards to the cesarean section. Thank you.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Catherine for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.